This is Dan White, author of the Smart Branding Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which has been named by Forbes and LinkedIn, amongst others, as one of the top marketing podcasts. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since I get to read every book featured on the show, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or any other resource I know of for whatever challenge you're facing, send me a LinkedIn connection invite with a message that you're a listener, and I will do my best to get you pointed in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. All right, let's get on with the show. Today we welcome back Dan White to talk about his book, The Smart Branding Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand, published by Lid Publishing. Dan White is a marketing insights innovator. His career includes a decade as an insights professional, another as a brand advisor, and a third as a chief marketing officer. He's the author of two other books, The Smart Marketing Book, The Definitive Guide to Effective Marketing Strategies, featured on episode 316 of the Marketing Book Podcast back in 2021, and The Soft Skills Book, The Key Difference to Becoming Highly Effective and Valued. Dan co-developed Brands, spelled B-R-A-N-D-Z, the world's biggest brand equity measurement system, and his thinking has shaped the design of leading copy test and brand tracking methodologies. As a brand and communications expert, he has advised famous billion-dollar brands on how to thrive, and his summaries and trademark visualizations have earned praise from luminaries in the marketing, advertising, and media industries. And, interesting fact, he lives near Stratford-upon-Avon, birthplace of William Shakespeare. Dan, congratulations on the Smart Branding Book, and welcome back to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me back. I mean, I'm amazed you invited me back, but I'm very, very, very pleased.
Are you kidding? I am a big fan of your books, as are some listeners we're going to talk about. Now, just a couple things I want to ask you about, because I'm so excited to be able to speak to you again. You live near Stratford-upon-Avon. I have never been there. And I was wondering, is there like a Shakespeare theme park with like roller coasters and things there?
Oh, no. I'm embarrassed you said that. No, it's a very classy place.
Oh. You know? Well, they should do that, you know.
No. We're British. We're very reserved. We're very respectful of our heritage.
No. Yeah, you know?
We're talking about hundreds of years ago.
I don't want to tell the folks in the town near you, you know, how to do things, but they should think about that. And I just, you know, Dan, there is no off position on the genius switch. So, Dan, let's move on here.
Hang on. We do have a big wheel. Does that count?
Like a big really wheel, big like wheel? A Ferris wheel.
A Ferris wheel? It used to be in Birmingham, which is obviously the second biggest
just up
city.
The road, yeah?
Just up the road, and they got bored of it. I don't know why.
And they brought they took it to Stratford?
Yeah,
oh,
sure.
You so see? Great minds think alike, Dan.
Sure. Okay, it's not a theme park. It's more classy than that, but, you know, move on.
Well, just something to think about. So, you know, Dan, now, speaking of Shakespeare's time, I was wondering, at your wedding reception, was this traditional English wedding song played?
It's a nice day for a white wedding.
Oh, no,
it's a very romantic song.
It's a beautiful romantic song. And hang on, it's bugging me now because I'm in my mid-50s now. And
that's,
I'm trying to remember.
No, Billy Idol.
Yes! I got it before the time limit.
Yes.
Yes. No, we didn't play that at our reception.
Well, listen, I hope that whenever you hear that song on the radio, it reminds you of your special day.
Thank you so much. That's very lovely of you.
Yeah. You know, it's great to be interviewing another author from the UK, and there seem to be a lot of Marketing Book Podcast listeners there. And I hear from them all the time, every week. And I recently had a call from a listener in England who had some suggestions for me on how to improve my interviews. Here's an excerpt from the call.
Shut up! Shut up! Will you shut up?
And I rarely hear from listeners, so, you know, I appreciate any kind of feedback from the listeners.
That was Monty Python-like.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, I thought, oh, lovely. That's part of our heritage, you know?
Yes.
Monty Python is, it is exactly what we're like in Britain.
Really? Well, and there's, as I told you, my English Golden Retriever, who is behind me right now sleeping, his name is Monty. Your English culture is everywhere.
Sure.
Anyway, as we record this, today is May 5th, or as it's called in the United States, Cinco de Mayo. And it's a celebration of Mexican heritage. And apparently it's not very well celebrated in Mexico, as far as I understand. It's more of a like a marketing innovation of beer and wine and tequila companies in the United States.
Tequila.
So in preparation for this interview, I've been drinking tequila all morning. So today is Cinco de Mayo, but tomorrow is the coronation of King Charles.
It is.
Will you be watching this on the BBC, perhaps?
King Charles III. Yes. Well, no. I think I'm going to go down to my local community centre.
Oh.
Because there's a big – it's a lovely community hall. I'm in a smallish village.
This is Bidford-on-Avon, right?
In Bidford-on-Avon, down the road from Stratford-on-Avon. And, yeah, they're going to have a huge screen – showing the coronation live, and all the people who come to what we call the warm hub, which is something I get involved with, come down, and we're going to all watch it together. So I'm hoping to go down there tomorrow.
That sounds great. Mm. Well, I was invited to the coronation by King Charles, but I had to decline because I'm interviewing you. So
I was going to say, is this a joke or something?
No, I wouldn't joke about this. King Charles and I, we exchanged some voice messages, and he said he was disappointed that I couldn't attend.
No, because by now you can't, your flights are going to, it's too late to get here.
Well, no, but he
I'm so sorry.
He understood, and he said, look, I understand, Douglas, the Marketing Book Podcast. I wish Dan White the best with his new book. I'll have to give him a call sometime. And he knew that I was worried that I was disappointing him, but he really put me at ease. And here's part of the voice message that he left for me.
Let not your heart be troubled.
He deeply understood how I felt. He's so empathetic.
That is so empathetic.
Yeah.
Do you know, my dad met him.
Really?
Wow. Yeah. My dad, he was a doctor, a general practitioner mainly, but he also served on lots of committees, to help further the cause of medicine in the UK. And he was awarded an MBE. Can you believe it? I'm very proud of him. Really proud of him. So he went to Buckingham Palace and he was awarded his MBE by, Prince Charles, as he was then, of course, about 20 years ago. So, yeah.
And tell folks outside the Commonwealth what MBE stands for.
Member of the British Empire. It's one of the awards that the sovereign of the state awards to gives to people.
Well, that is really very, very impressive. So let's get on to the book here.
I think we should, because we've been talking for like 25 minutes and we haven't even talked about marketing yet.
Well, just a little bit. Cinco de Mayo, it's a marketing invention.
Yeah.
So the book is endorsed by a number of people, including two professors for whom I have great respect. One of them is Professor Byron Sharp, director of the Ehrenberg Bass Institute and author of How Brands Grow, which we're going to talk about. And he wrote, on one hand, I do worry that simplified, quote, marketing for dummies type books don't reflect well on our profession. On the other hand, this book is better than most university brand management books, which for all their seriousness, do a poor job of representing the real evidence.
Yeah.
Wow. That's quite an endorsement. And also, there's a endorsement from Professor Thomas Elmer, marketing professor at Westchester University in Pennsylvania. And he writes, hundreds of books have been published on the topic of brand building, yet not one compares to this outstanding new book by Dan White. No one comes close to Dan's unique and effective style of business education. And Professor Tom Elmer is an acquaintance of mine. He's been a longtime listener of the Marketing Book Podcast, and I first got to know him one day a few years ago when a bottle of scotch showed up at my office from him.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's how I first learned him. He said, I love your show. I've been using it all in my classes. And now The reason I mention that is I've moved on from Scotch to Cabernet Sauvignon. So if there are any listeners that would like to send me a bottle of wine,
you're free
to do that.
That's cheap, Douglas. Come on.
If you're in the UK, take care of Dan. So, and then a couple years ago, Professor Elmer was in town where I live here in Virginia with his lovely wife, and they took me out to dinner at a very nice restaurant, which was very generous of them to do. And again, to the listeners, if you happen to be anywhere near where I live, you don't have to, you know, take me to a fancy restaurant like the Elmers did. There are several Taco Bells in my city, and you're afraid to take me out to dinner. So,
yo quiero Taco Bell.
So, Douglas, do you usually use your podcast to try and get freebies? Is that the only reason I do it? Yeah, sure. Yeah. No, I get that. But to be honest, that's
tacos and wine. Yeah.
And tacos and wine. No, but Tom, I think he sent me something much more valuable than was it Scotch?
Yes, he sent me some Scotch.
No, he sent me the most wonderful thing, and it's a trophy, right? And it says Dan White, 2021 Marketing Guru Champion, and it's a magnificent trophy.
Wow!
I know, and it's like about a foot and a half tall, and at the top it has this sort of golden figurine, I suppose you call it, of someone throwing an axe. Now you cannot beat that.
No,
I use this in all my training videos to say, look, take me seriously. See this? That's from Tom.
I don't have one of those, so
no, exactly,
you know.
Exactly. So, my apologies.
That's great. That is great. And you know, I've actually been invited to speak to his class, his marketing students, and he is the most enthusiastic marketing professor. And I just hope that his students appreciate, maybe when they're older, they'll appreciate how good he is and enthusiastic, and he really focuses on the right things. Yeah. He and I are of the same mind. So this is another one of your very short books, and I applaud you for writing a short book, because it occurs to me that it's much more difficult to write a short book than a long book. And also, you know, there's something about me as a reader. When an author writes a really short book about a big topic, they generally really know what they're talking about. Yeah, I think you certainly do. And also, you drew all the wonderful illustrations in this book. So when you asked if I've ever seen you, I've only seen illustrations of you. I've never actually seen a photo. So, and in your intro, I mentioned all these illustrations. They are just wonderful. It's amazing. So,
thank you.
I want to read an excerpt from page 2, and we'll dive into a few questions here. You write, a company's long-term commercial success relies on it delivering products or services that live up to customers' expectations. This drives repeat purchasing. In any competitive market, however, a growth strategy based on product superiority is unsustainable. Innovations are soon copied since patents only offer limited protection. Competitors launch me-too products without high research and development costs. This makes brand building a necessary tool to drive growth and profit while making the brand more resilient to competitive threats. The concept of a brand is straightforward. It is something potential customers recognize that conjures a set of mental associations. Powerful positive associations make people more likely to buy the product, while negative associations may drive them away. However, building a successful brand is not simple. It delivers large commercial rewards, but requires money, creativity, and patience. The Smart Branding Book is for anyone looking to understand why brand building is a sound investment, as well as how to conceive, nurture, and get the most from a brand.
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
Dan White, let's go to page 9. And you write, a brand can mean different things to different people. I think that's certainly true. Please share with us your definition that's useful for marketers.
Yeah, I thought about this a lot. I think it's important for marketers to really understand what a brand is in terms of how it exists in the consumer's brain. Because it only exists really in the consumer's brain. I mean, a useful way of thinking about a brand is that it is all of the mental connections and the responses to those mental connections that people have in relation to the brand's name in their mind. Does that make sense to you, Douglas?
Absolutely. And that's why it's so difficult. Because so many things can make up those perceptions. And actually, there's a great line on 12, page 12. You see, branding refers to the efforts a company makes to shape consumer perceptions to make its products more likely to be bought at the asking price.
Price, yeah.
So it really exists in the mind of that consumer, and it's not a logo. It's not what you say about yourself, generally, I think. And I think that people aren't terribly trustful of what companies say about themselves. But we mentioned Byron Sharpe earlier. Let's now talk about how brands grow, as well as the book, How Brands Grow. So on page 13, you write that there are four ways to grow your brand, which might not surprise some folks. You know, get more people to buy it, charge more for it, get existing buyers to buy it more often, and retain more customers than previously. And you go on to write that in practice, long-term growth almost always comes from getting more people to buy your brand. Can you talk about all the scientific evidence that is in Byron Sharpe's book that supports this?
It's kind of like, it's a truth. It's absolutely unrefutable when you look at all the evidence, which is that if you want to grow, you can grow your brand temporarily for a few months or whatever by doing some tactical things. But if you want to grow a big, big brand, you are going to need more people to buy you over time. You know, more customers for more reasons. It just doesn't, there's no data that suggests you can grow it purely by just cranking up the price again and again and again. Yes, you can get a short-term gain from that.
Just like selling more to your current customers will help you.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It will help you, but a little bit, and for the short term. Mm-hmm. But it's really limited. I mean, you look at the relationships between brand size and penetration. Bigger brands have more buyers. They just do. They don't have, you know, a small amount of buyers buying them again and again or paying a huge premium. It just doesn't work that way. If you want to grow in the long term, you're going to have to attract more people to your brand and get them to buy it and to carry on buying it. Now, that doesn't mean to say, you know, this has lots of implications. It for one thing, it means that your product has to be good. Because I know it sounds obvious, but people don't always think that way. If a good product means you don't lose people, and therefore you attract people and you use less. The leaky bucket is one of the most useful analogies, I think, in all of marketing. At any point in time, there will be people who drift away from your brand for a load of reasons. Yeah. Some of them you have no opportunity to prevent. You know, it could be their life stage changes and the product or the category is no longer relevant to them, etc. So you need to keep on attracting more people. And if you attract more people than you lose, your penetration grows and your brand grows. And it's almost as simple as that, I would say.
It's interesting because, longtime listeners may have heard me remind them that most companies aren't doing enough to sell to their current customers. And they should do that. But it's interesting where you write about you and Byron Sharpe write about how, you know, marketing activities designed mainly for existing customers are unlikely to help grow your brand. So it's helpful. Can you explain the concept of mental availability, which Byron Sharpe talks about, and which was actually recently discussed in my interview with Louis Gadima about the second edition of his book Bullseye Marketing, where he was talking about the same book by Byron Sharpe.
Well, yeah, I think mental availability is an important concept for marketers. The way I think of it is, you know, successful brands come to mind very quickly and very easily when people are thinking about buying the category. Mm-hmm. That's my definition of mental availability. In other words, I need a new car. I need a new sweatshirt. I don't know where that came from, but you know, it's like, well, okay, when you think about your needs, you think about, you know, I need this thing. If a brand comes to mind, it has a much better chance of being chosen than bands that don't come to mind. And there's a bias. It's one of the many biases in the brain. It's like the brain usually thinks that the brand, the thing that comes to mind is probably right. Now, mm-hmm. I think that's quite fascinating. And that's because you have to make quick decisions if you go back in time, you know, to survive. You know, if you – I usually use a lion or a tiger in this example. But, you know, if it's like a tiger comes into view and you go, you know, my gut instinct is that this is dangerous and I should run the other way. You know, it helps. It's helpful. But – that same instinct means that if something comes to mind quickly, it's probably the right thing. And that's why mental availability of a brand is probably more important than most people think it is.
Yes. And you're right. Mental availability is created and maintained through brand building. Brands grow if they are mentally available and physically available, i.e. Yep. quick and easy to buy, where and when consumers want to buy the category. So let's jump to another topic, which is of great interest to me, and I think it's misunderstood. And it actually came up quite a bit in another recent interview with Andy Milligan on the book he co-authored, Myths of Branding, which I recommend to everyone. If you haven't seen that, I think you'd really like that book. He lives in London, so I'm happy to introduce you guys.
Thanks.
Let's talk about who is responsible for branding. And I want to jump over to page 80. You write that in some companies, brand building is the sole responsibility of the marketing team. The brand is seen as a consequence of advertising. However, this mode of thinking gets in the way. Explain what you mean there and who is responsible for branding.
Well, everyone in the company, kind of. I mean, why is it branding? I mean,
and yet companies want to say, "Oh no, that's a marketing department thing."
Yeah, but to be honest, the team that has the biggest influence on branding is probably the R&D department. The people who come up with a product that's going to be sold, you know, because fundamentally, a good product that people experience and love the experience and feel it's exactly what they wanted and it's better than other ones they've tried, that is one of the biggest driver back to how people perceive the brand. Mm-hmm. Because they've had an experience of it. The experience of brand is the biggest influence on their brand perceptions. Now, it's not to say that advertising and other influences aren't important, but they are probably secondary.
Yes.
In the long run, to the actual product or service experience. Mm-hmm. So for me, the product is always going to be king. You know, you need to have a great product. And for me, product encompasses customer experience that is wrapped around the product. And therefore, you know, that's important. Advertising can amplify the effects of having a good product by flagging it and highlighting it to lots of people who will then try it and love it.
Sure, which I think was probably more powerful back in the days of the captive audience, which we no longer have, and everyone now has a megaphone. So it's all these different experiences that influence the brand, which is why, like you said, the customer experience is really so important, as well as the product. Where should marketers focus their limited resources?
It goes back to that question of mental availability. I think that the most important thing that marketers can do is to make their brand as memorable and salient as possible. Now, the reason I say that is because we know that just having great salience of a brand encourages people to actually try it. And then after that, of course, that the experience itself will have a big influence on whether they like it and buy it again.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. So I think it's just important that, you know, the CEO is basically responsible for the brand because there's so much more that goes into it than just what the marketing folks are working on. The way your company sells is a big part of your brand because it influences all those perceptions people have about right. your company. So, Dan, as I mentioned, as we record this, today is Cinco de Mayo. So let's talk about pinatas. Okay. Yes.
That's one of my favorite topics.
I had actually a feeling.
No, well, kind of. It's also one of my sorest topics.
Ooh. Well, now you've gotten everyone's interest. I want to write, let's see, on page 41, you write, you can define what you want your brand to become using the brand pinata.
Yeah.
Which was first introduced in the Smart Marketing book. Yeah. So, Señor Blanco, ¿qué es la pinata?
Oh, I get the Mexican theme at last. Thank you. Sorry, I'm a bit slow. But yeah, I've got it now. No, this is a sore point for me, I'm afraid.
Uh-oh. Well,
okay, look,
let's hear it.
I'll tell you the truth. Okay.
It's just you and me, so, you know.
Okay.
No one's probably listening at this point anyway.
No. We've waffled on too much. I came up with the brand pinata, which is the only thing that is repeated between my first book, The Smart Marketing Book, and my new book, The Smart Branding Book, right? Because it's central to everything, so I had to repeat it. I hope, you know.
Hopefully, if there was one thing to bring forward, it was definitely going to be that. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, and even this knuckleheaded interviewer, he even remembered
spotted it.
So yeah,
he spotted it. Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. The thing is, I thought it was one of my breakthrough moments where I thought, oh, I've got a framework, and not only a framework, but a framework that I can use in all of the wonderful consultancy workshops I'm going to sell on the back of my first book. Okay. And I thought, I'm not joking, I even bought a pinata, the classic kind of star-shaped pinata.
Yes, like you've illustrated in the book.
Like the illustration from Amazon, only about 20 or 30 pounds, I can't remember, and all the sweets to fill it with. And I had this vision of running these wonderful, wonderful workshops where we would talk around the concepts of the pinata, which we may cover in a minute. But more importantly, at key moments during the workshop, I would hand the brand manager this huge, what's the word? Is it a baton?
A stick
to hit the pinata.
Here in America, we use baseball bats.
Yeah, perfect. Absolutely. In Britain, we'd use rounders bats. You can look it up on Google later. And the idea is, once we'd nailed an aspect of the brand we needed to define, one of the arms of the pinata, that brand manager or whoever led that section would be able to hit it and release the wonderful sweets from it. And by the end of it, we'd have beaten the pinata and gorged ourselves on all the glucose.
Sign me up. I want to be there. Have you done this?
You see, I told you it was a sore point. No, never. Because I came up with this about a month before the first UK lockdown. I know. And, things move on and you get onto other things. So it's never happened. If anyone out there who's based in a location that I can fly to conveniently without using too much aviation fuel, I would love to do this.
All right. Let's make it happen, people.
Let's make it happen.
Yeah.
It would be so fun and hopefully relevant to your business as well.
So let's go through the pinata. Talk about that.
Okay, so yeah, it has 1, 2, 3, 4, 6.
It's an acronym.
It is indeed an acronym, where the P stands for proposition. I always use Snickers. The candy bar. Snickers,
great example.
It's the best example, so it's the clearest. It's the clearest example, so I tend to use it. So the proposition is, Snickers, it fills you up when you're hungry, right? Simple as that. Very simple. What does it do for you? Now, the insight that they have used to develop some amazing advertising is their insight related to the brand proposition is that people's temperament changes when they're hungry. In fact, when I first did this chart, I hadn't heard of the word hangry. Have you come across hangry?
Oh, I think so. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's emerged, obviously. You get angry when you're hungry. Mm-hmm. People know that. It's an insight people recognize related to food. So that's P-I. At the N of pinata is there are needs that the brand Snickers fulfills, right? And they include things like people need a mid-morning snack quite often. Sometimes they need a snack on the go, you know, like when they're traveling and they haven't got time for a proper meal. And let's face it, sometimes you get the late night munchies, and a Snickers bar is perfect for that. So you have a set of needs the brand fulfills worth defining. So that's P-I-N. A. A is associations. Okay. So that is, what associations does the brand team want people to connect with in their minds? So, for example, the concept of it being satisfying, mm-hmm. or revitalizing, or tasty, these are all relevant associations that will help the brand be compelling. Right, where are we up to? T, test for R. Okay. You know, with any acronym, there's usually one of the letters that isn't quite as good as the others. Now, testaments.
Hey, let's not beat up on the pinata.
No,
if you know what
no
I mean.
I'm not beating. Oh, I see what you did there. Yeah, but if you look it up on whatever.
Testaments.
Dictionary.com. The word testaments, it is absolutely spot on, so I allowed mm-hmm. it into my acronym. It's basically things that prove your point, you know, that are testimony to your point. And in this case, the fact that Snickers is full of things like nutritious peanuts and the caramel, which has glucose, they give you energy, right? They restore you when you need glucose. Perfect. So that's the T. And then is it finally Pinata? Yes, it is. Mm-hmm. Assets. Now, this is the one I go on and on and on about. And I think it's something that a lot of brand people neglect or don't put as much focus on as they should, which is assets, as in distinctive brand assets.
Yes.
Highlighted again by the Ehrenberg Bass Institute as being important for brand success. And oh, wow. I am absolutely passionate about the value that they bring. They're things that just help your brand to be distinctive and memorable. And in the case of Snickers, just even the phrase, you're not you when you're hungry,
mm-hmm.
is really powerful. It's a phrase that's associated with brand that helps it be memorable and connected to all the things I just talked about.
Yes, and you've got a couple chapters on distinctive brand assets and what they are and do's and don'ts. Very helpful. I want to go back to the area where I think it's near the pinata section where I found this interesting. You talk about the limitations of focusing on a subset of category buyers. Can you explain, you know, the importance of moving away from these consumer segments and towards usage contexts?
Yeah. I mean, the two are related, of course.
But in the past, it's almost like it was maniacally, it was just segments. Within
like demographic
base.
Or
right,
whatever.
Right, yeah. Yeah.
That is one approach, but I think what I hope we've all learned from the Ehrenberg Bass Institute and Byron Sharp is that really what you're trying to do is you're trying to make your brand be seen and relevant and come to mind when people are thinking about a whole variety of different usage contexts. Byron Sharp uses the phrase category entry points,
mm-hmm.
which is fine, but I find that a bit technical. I think they are just usage contexts, as in
being hungry with the Snickers bar, rather than saying this is just for young people 18 to 24.
Exactly, because you know that's fine, but actually there are people of, for example, 53. Picking a random age out of the hat, who sometimes get hungry, right, when they're on the go. So actually, when you're hungry on the go and you need something to keep you going, is a usage context or category entry point. And actually, it's better for marketers to think about how can we make Snickers come to mind when people are on the go and they're hungry. That's what you want to do. And that, they could be of any age.
Mm-hmm.
That's how the brain works. You know, the brain goes, oh, I need something now.
Yes.
So I think segmentation based on demographics isn't ideal. I think segmentation still has its role, but it's more actually about how you segment your audience to efficiently reach them with media, which is quite a different question if you think about it.
Yes, and I think that I wonder if it's a hangover from the days of when advertising was much more powerful. And there was more of a captive audience. It's just a speculation on my part.
Makes sense.
So, but even to page 47, you're right. Even a well-established brand can grow by creating a strong connection with a major usage context. So usage context, very important. Let's jump to another section. You write – actually, it was very next page. Investors seem keen to fund technology-based brands even if they've never made a profit. But this isn't wise, and you go on to write, profit-focused brands are better set for future growth. By contrast, unprofitable growth-focused brands have a comparatively smaller chance of making a long-term profit. Can you explain what is what you mean by a profit-focused brand?
Yeah, no, I think this is about your business, not your business model exactly, but your business plan, your long-term business plan. Because I think there has been an emphasis on the idea that you create something. And it's appealing, and you invest and invest to get loads and loads and loads of people using it. But, and this is where, you know, even companies like Netflix is an interesting one because we'll see how that pans out. But, you know, you invest so much and you make no money. In fact, you lose money for a long, long time. I mean, right. many
Amazon
years.
Comes to mind as another example of that.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But the point is, like, can you then convert that into profit, you know, by effectively, let's be honest, increasing your price later on once you've got lots of customers. Now, we've known that, for example, Netflix have struggled when they've tried to increase their price significantly. But the reason for that is because whilst they've been building their customer base, competitors have come along. I mean, you know, Disney and in the UK, Amazon Prime, they offer a lot at a lower price. So, you know, the market gets competitive. So you have to be able to make a profit. There was a wonderful analysis that's referred to in the book. It's Johansson in 2009 that kind of looked at the companies that succeeded in the long term in terms of making genuine money. And it was really, really clear that it's better to start off as a small enterprise that's making a profit amongst a small customer base because you've got something that people really, really, really want and are prepared to pay money for, and then expanding that around the whole world. I mean, you know, Ben and Jerry's did this. You know, Häagen-Dazs and Ben and Jerry's both did this, you know. Whereas creating something that's wonderful because you've underpriced it and you're making a loss – great. But when you try and expand that or try and when you try and make money from that, you find it might not be possible. And I think it's fundamentally important. It's all about value. If you can create something that is valuable to consumers at the price that you're asking for it, then you can extend that around the whole world.
Yes, it's the enhanced Ansoff matrix.
Yes.
Johansson.
Oh, exactly.
2009. Yeah, page 49. Exactly. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah.
So moving on, purpose-led branding is all the rage these days. It's what all the cool kids are talking about. However, share with us what some of the perils are of a poorly done purpose-led branding.
Well, I think it's like it's tricky, this, because, you know, from a moral, ethical point of view, I would love to say that, you know, brands that are ethical and produce products sustainably, etc., are going to be more successful. But the data doesn't say that, you know. So it's always a bit difficult to actually, you know, express the fact that actually companies that use purpose-driven campaigns tend to do actually less well. Sorry, those campaigns tend to be much less successful than others. It's just really awkward. I mean, I think it's because purpose. A lot of companies have tried to create purpose when there isn't really a genuine purpose, right. and that kind of contaminates the stats. You know, does that make?
Oh, absolutely. You say this approach is likely to backfire. Yeah. If the company's actions are found to be inconsistent with the stance taken by its brands.
Yeah.
And let's see, on the next page you write, in the long run, only brands that practice what they preach will be able to leverage their connection with the cause they support. And it was – this is – you just touched on this. Peter Field in 2021 did research who – and he suggests that brand purpose campaigns are no more effective than any other type of communication. I was very surprised.
No, they're not. But that could be because a lot of campaigns that are categorized as brand purpose aren't really. They're more just an advertising campaign that talks about some narrow aspect of the company.
Okay.
Do you see what I mean? It's tricky. I don't think we've come to the bottom of this. I mean, there are clearly brands that have succeeded because they stand for something that a large and growing segment of consumers care about and are prepared to pay for. You know, and I think that's absolutely right. It's more your big corporations that have been around forever that try and advertise something that makes them seem slightly less awful than they than people think they are. You know, and those don't work because people see through them.
Yes, and a great line is on, let's see, page 56, mm-hmm. where you write, commitment to a cause is a company decision, not a communications option.
Yeah, exactly, that's... Yes, I wish I said it myself. Oh, I did.
Well, no, but, of course, I just read the book, so I'm a little more up to speed on this. But I thought that was very interesting, and we all want this. It's like we want to root for brands that are doing this, and obviously you need to have a good product. You're not supposed to be you're supposed to pay your taxes, pay your employees well, have an ethical supply chain. Don't break the law. All those are good things. I mean, and we want more of that. But then sometimes what's the term? It's not greenwashing, but it's
I know what you mean. Yeah,
woke washing, or I can't remember what the term is. I've heard for this. So it's not good. Well, let's go to another section here. Well, let's talk a little bit more about distinctive brand assets.
I'm glad you said that. It's my favorite topic of all.
We'll talk about what they are and how they are developed and how they're often ruined.
Well, they're developed by the brand team with their communications agencies and media agencies coming up with really
– What's an example of some distinctive brand assets, I guess I should have said first.
Okay. I guess some of my favorite examples include things like, Colonel Sanders, especially his face and his little what's that called? It's not a bow tie. In the UK, we call it a bow tie, but it's not quite the same.
Yes. I don't know.
Is there a word for that? It feels very Southern American. I don't know if it is. But anyway, it's part of the brand. His face in that silhouette is a very powerful, distinctive brand asset. It's a visual one, right? You can have colors. Well, more colors combined with a graphic. So Vodafone have a kind of a speech mark, a speech bubble. In a circle that's colored in red. But some of my favorite ones are more things like Toblerone, the chocolate Toblerone.
Mm-hmm.
Literally the shape, which originally was modeled on, is it Mont Blanc in Switzerland? I think it is, where it came from. That shape is incredibly distinctive. There's no other chocolate shape like that. That is a distinctive brand asset. My favorite of all, and I've done this most embarrassing video to illustrate these, and I would recommend no one to ever look it up on YouTube, but to look at rituals that brands have successfully connected to their brand to make the brand more distinctive. Things like Oreos, twist, lick, dunk.
Yes.
Genius. Total genius. In the UK and Ireland and probably other places as well, I guess, Guinness, they've made a distinctive brand asset around the idea of the fact it takes forever to pour it in a pub or even with the widget, the can with the widget. They created a ceremony. Is that the right word? I think it is. Around how you prepare the drink before you you consume it.
I've studied that ceremony for hours in pubs. You? Yeah, just doing research for my podcast.
Sure, sure. And then did you drink them as well, or did you just...
Well, yeah, I had to, you know, in order to get another one, I had to drink it. So,
but no, that makes sense. That makes
I suffer sense. For my art, Dan.
No, I get you. I get you. That's you know, that's very honorable of you. But also, things like music and sound can be very powerful.
Yes, that okay? McDonald's or even the Intel.
Hang on, that wasn't Intel. That was definitely McDonald's.
No.
Unless you're saying I can't, you know.
No, there's no McDonald's, which you talk about in the book, but also didn't you talk about Intel here, where they had a certain.
Okay. Can I attempt that one as well?
Yes. Yes.
Interestingly, I didn't realize that there were five notes of that. I thought it was dung 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 dung, but it's not. It's dung 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 dung. Now I know that sounds like a little, you know, detail, but actually I talked to a sonic branding expert and they said no, the first note with a slightly larger pause helps people to go, oh, I need to listen now. Isn't that genius? Honestly, that's real experts know what they're doing. If you go to sonic branding experts, they know what they're doing. Yeah. And obviously, just to finish this off, you've got things like words. Just do it from Nike is a brilliant distinctive brand asset.
How are companies damaging their brand assets? Lack of consistency?
Well, it's not that. Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of companies fail to build a strong brand assets because they don't stick with them.
Yes, yes.
For long enough. They don't use them consistently enough across channels and over time, and therefore they never build. Or they have an amazing asset and then they throw it away by deciding because a new CMO comes in that, we want to move on. And then they're wasting all the investment they've put into that asset.
Right. I think you have an example of Tropicana Orange Juice doing that, where they had a very distinctive visual asset, and they ruined it, and it cost them a lot of money.
Temporarily, it did, but they realized what went wrong fairly quickly and reversed it. But you're right. And they had an asset. I love visual metaphors. That's one of my favorite kind of assets. And they had and still have now on their pack, you have a fresh orange, an orange with a straw pushed directly into the orange. Now, for me, that signals so much implicitly. Mm-hmm. It says, this is like fresh orange juice, right? And that is very powerful. And then at one point in time, they removed that from the pack and changed the pack quite dramatically. And what happened was that people couldn't find their normal juice, the juice they've bought the last few times, the Tropicana orange juice. And sales plummeted massively until they, you know, reversed the packaging.
Well, let me ask you, on page 96, you have one of your many illustrations. It's this illustration of a skull and crossbones. So with that visual in the listener's mind now, Dan, let's talk about death. How do brands die? And they do die.
Well, they do die. I mean, normally they suffer a long and painful death, I suppose, because they get neglected or they stop investing in their assets or they stop investing at all in the brand. And maybe that's a conscious decision, you know, to a cash cow, no, a cash cow, a failing star, whatever it's called, you know, to invest more in other things. And that's fine. That's normal. But sometimes a brand can die through some horrible mistake by the company. And I think that's probably what you're alluding to, right?
Well, I would say that I wonder if the death of individual brands is actually accelerating. In other words, we're in an era of even, you know, the quick and the dead, where it seems like if you look at companies that are on, let's say, a stock index like the S&P 500, the amount of time they're on there is shortening.
Shorter.
every 10 years, there's fewer companies are staying on there. And I'm wondering if brands are dying even faster now.
Well, yes, that's quite possible because of technology changes. Mm-hmm. I think that could be true. I haven't looked into this particularly, but there are lots of cases of brands that have died because they haven't embraced new technology or haven't been prepared to change their business model fast enough, and a competitor has come in.
Product innovation seems to be increasingly more important now.
I think it is, yeah.
One other thing on here that I just loved on page 102, and this reminds me of where David Merriman Scott, the author of The New Rules of Marketing PR, he often writes this and he says it on his keynotes. No one cares about your product except you. It's so true. And on page 102, you write, the challenge for marketers is that very little of what people experience in daily life is important enough to be worth remembering.
Yeah, of course.
Talk about the role that creativity plays in enhancing memorability and distinctiveness. And I often, I wonder if creativity has taken sort of a back seat in the last 20 or 30 years with the decline of advertising. I don't know, just a theory.
Yeah, well, I think the decline of, what you might call brand building advertising and the rise of activation advertising certainly reflects that. I think it's really important that this is what I love to talk about, which is like fundamentally how do people's minds navigate daily life. And let's be honest, if we attended to everything we were exposed to, especially every advertising message, especially every advertising message, we'd explode. We're exposed to thousands of advertising messages in a typical day, especially if we live in a city and commute or whatever. And we cannot attend to all of those things. We just can't. We've got other things to do. We're trying to think about which train we need to catch, or what we need to do when we get into the office at 9 o'clock, or what our partners are thinking about, and there's too much going on. So we filter out most of everything.
Right, and it goes back to what you mentioned earlier about the tiger. We're still looking for the tiger. Our brains are such great filtering.
We're scanning. Yeah. We're scanning. In fact, pre-consciously, we are scanning for the tiger. Mm-hmm. We are scanning everything, right? In case there is the exception, which, and it is a rare exception, that something may be of danger or opportunity to us. Mm-hmm. That's the way I think about it. And a danger would be, you're going down on the subway, right? And you're on the platform. If a tiger were to come along, it doesn't happen that often, I guess. Mm. Our scanning should go, hang on, I think that might be a tiger. Right? Mm-hmm. Do something about it. Or, for example, it might be someone on the platform looks absolutely gorgeous to us.
Oh, probably a Marketing Book podcast listener.
Almost certainly. You said that earlier. You said that they were all attractive. I don't know where you got that data, but you did say it before we came on air.
Oh, it's researched thoroughly.
Well, yeah, you did claim that.
Yeah.
Sure.
Trust the science on that one.
Yeah, I trust you completely, Douglas. But if you do, again, that's an opportunity that, suddenly it's not normal. It's like, oh my God, there's someone there that has grabbed my attention.
Right. Okay. Or it could be somebody that you're afraid might push you onto the tracks or something, some sort of danger.
Well, like the tiger.
Yes, exactly.
We're getting confused now. I mean, tigers would eat you and or push you. They wouldn't push you onto the track because then they wouldn't. Look, it doesn't matter. We're getting confused.
I just think listeners need to be careful on the subway. We can leave it at that.
No, you should. Yeah. Be careful on subway, but look out for someone that you find attractive. That's what we're saying.
There you go.
It's really straightforward. Mm-hmm. But the point is your subconscious brain does this anyway. Otherwise, mm-hmm. you just carry on, listening to your podcast of the, Marketing Book podcast, almost certainly. And you don't need to attend to anything else because it's just normal. It's what you saw yesterday, the day before, and the day before that. Mm-hmm. So, getting back to your question, which is where creativity is important, because creativity usually means something different, original, interesting, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay, you get into the train carriage. You're sitting there, you glance up and you see this really original ad up above. What's it called? What are those ads called? I don't even know. But you know what I mean. In the carriage ads.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I think we need to, can we just re-edit this with a technical term there? Because otherwise I sound like I don't know what I'm talking about. But you know what I mean.
Yeah. They're like little cards up inside the
cards.
The frame.
The cards,
yeah.
Above, just above people's heads so you can still read them. You know, if something there captures your eye because it's different, original, interesting, suddenly you pay attention. If not, you won't. And that's where, you know, the variability is huge between advertising like that, just for example, on a card in a tube, can either grab almost no one's attention because it looks just like any other ad I've seen a thousand times before, or something that grabs my eye for whatever reason, you know, and looks interesting, relevant to me. Now that can make your advertising like 10 times more effective.
Yes, and there are so many other opportunities for creativity, you know, like back to product innovation or the way you price your thing. Maybe you have a different pricing
right.
program, all kinds
yeah.
of things.
Right.
The creativity is really the secret weapon. You mentioned just a moment ago about brand building and sales activation, and that's a big part of the work that Byron Sharp has done.
Right.
Can you explain what is meant by those two different ends of the stick, the brand building and the sales activation? And you started to touch on how the sales activation seems to have the upper hand versus, I guess, brand building in, you know, the last however many years.
A few years, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a useful – I mean, obviously, it's a model. And as I say, models are – you know, frameworks are – they're all wrong, but some are useful.
But I think that too many companies think that they should do one or the other when there's actually a mixture here that is really powerful.
Yeah. Well, the evidence from Binet and Field in particular, I think is pretty compelling that mm-hmm. a mixture and, you know, whether it's 60-40 or 40-60, you know, the ratio of spend behind trying to do those two things, you need both. You know, mm-hmm. If you have a mix, it's more powerful. The concept is that brand building is the idea of building mental associations around your brand, right? I hope that makes sense. In other words, making your brand a more memorable entity in people's brains.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That's brand building. It's making it more memorable, and the more memorable it is, the more compelling it feels when it comes to mind or you see it. In other words, it's like, I think of it as brand predisposition.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so because of what you might call brand building advertising, the brand has lots and lots of rich and positive associations connected with it that fire in the brain when people come across it or think about the category. That's brand building. Now, that's all very well. But the thing is, people aren't always in the window for buying something. You know, even milk is not necessarily bought every week, or bread, and cars are bought every, 6 years or something on average. So you can still build a brand when people aren't about to buy it. You can build a compelling set of associations around the brand way before people actually are about to buy the category. Now, activation is all about triggering those wonderful memories and associations at a point in time when people are about to decide which brand to buy. And that's, I think, what people call activation. It's like the two, you know, and you might do, if you're bought online, then Google search is a fantastic way of reminding people at the right moment when they're searching for, oh, I want to buy a wetsuit. I know that's a random example, but that's what I've put in my new book that I'm writing at the moment. Anyway, you know, I want to buy a wetsuit, and you put which wetsuit should I buy, or which are the best brands of wetsuit?
Right, you're a little further along yeah. on the buyer's journey or the sales funnel,
yeah,
or whatever you want to talk
yes,
about.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're at that point where you really need or want to buy it now-ish, you know, soon. And, you know, if you've already – Quiksilver was a brand that came to my mind for wetsuits because it's the only brand I really knew. I don't swim or dive. and if that brand – I don't know why I chose that example, a bit randomly.
Well, clearly you have James Bond on the mind, but
– I do. Oh, we could get onto product placement and Amiga in a minute. But anyway, no. Yeah. Okay. I want to be James Bond, so I was thinking about this even though – those brands, when you see in the search results Quicksilver dot dot dot, and you go, oh yeah, Quicksilver. Oh,
I've heard of them.
I've heard of them.
Right,
I think they're good, aren't they? That's what my brain is. That's what my mind is triggering. I've heard of them. They're salient. They're good.
Right, that's where the brand building comes in.
Yeah, you're 10 times more likely to click on that link and explore it and possibly buy it.
Yes. So I think that I just hear a lot of people say, no, we're not doing that glossy stuff. We're not doing that brand build. All we're doing is, you know, just lead gen. It's like, yeah. Back to the book by Louis Gadima that I just mentioned. I mentioned earlier, or that was on the show recently. He explained in chapter 13 of that book about how the sales activation would drop off for a lot of companies not long after they stopped their brand building efforts, so that they really work together quite well. And if you only try and do one, you're really doing it kind of the hard way. So,
I know it's. I almost wish that Binet and Field's analysis said it was 50-50 because it would be so much easier to explain. You need both. The data they come up with actually is there's a slight bias towards brand building on average, as in 60% of your budget spent on brand building and 40% on activation is the optimum. But of course, that varies by category anyway, so who cares? It's do both. That's the message.
Yeah, and you can start to tweak it. And you talk about how in certain instances where you probably should do more sales activation and other instances where you might do better to do more to mix in a little more brand building. So you're an expert on brand measurement, as I mentioned earlier. What are some of the key performance indicators that companies should be monitoring as it relates to brand building?
Well, I think there's a hierarchy. I'm always trying to simplify things as much as possible. I think there are probably, if you want two measures of brand, let's call it, you know, if you're brand tracking or something, you can get a lot from just two measures. And actually it relates to what we've just been talking about. One is, I think it's usually referred to as a spontaneous or unaided brand awareness. Mm-hmm. So that would be probably my number one metric if I were building a brand right now, I would measure. Now, effectively, it is saying that when you say to people, you know, what brand of wetsuit can you think of, right? Mm-hmm. What brands come to mind? Because that effectively is a simple way of asking about whether the brand is top of mind, you know, whether or not it's salient enough to be worth. The brain will think that is worth considering, a good one. So if you ask me and I go Quicksilver, if that comes to mind and no others do, which is what happened to me, by the way, when I was doing this recently, thinking about it recently, Quicksilver has a massive advantage in terms of which one I'm going to buy just because it came to mind first, right? So that measure, and there are different versions of that measure, but some measure like that is incredibly important. But there is another metric you need to combine with it, which you would normally call consideration. Because there's two things. It's like, which brands came to mind spontaneously?
Yeah, there might be bad. There might be bad.
Yes.
Associations.
There are often bad associations. And that's where the consideration is more about the rational side of the brain that might overrule it, right? Mm-hmm. So, for example, I do apologize, Douglas, if I use this same example in our last podcast, because I'm 54 and I cannot remember exactly what I've said to whom when. But right, when
we talked before,
who are you? Okay, when I went freelance 4 years ago, right, and I'd had a company car for like 20, 30 years, actually, nearly 30 years. And so I just chose a lovely company car and everyone paid for it. It was lovely. The good old days.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. But then I thought, right, I'm now a freelancer. And who knows if I'm going to earn any money over the next 12 months. We'll see. Mm-hmm. And guess which brand, and I needed a new car, obviously, because the company car, you know, had gone. Guess which brand came to my mind spontaneously as the brand I ought to consider?
Well, the one that you had been using in the past?
Interestingly, no. It was even better than the ones.
And
it was
a Jaguar?
You're close.
Land Rover?
You're very close.
Hmm.
I'm going to keep going with this until our...
Oh, BMW?
No,
Rolls-Royce. A Rolls Royce. There you go.
No, I know. Come on. Come on. Surely you know me better, even after just two podcasts. No, I'll put you out of your misery. It was a Tesla.
Oh, okay.
Because it made me feel I'd be driving in the car similar to Knight Rider from, and you'll remember that. Half your listeners won't. You do remember Knight Rider, surely.
I'm familiar with that show. I'm not sure I ever saw it.
Oh, come on. You must have. Actually, who was in that? It wasn't Hasselhoff, was it? It might have been.
I think it was.
I think it might
be. I don't know.
Be.
If there's any German listeners, they can tell us, because he's very popular in Germany.
He's popular in Germany. He's a weird... Sorry. Exactly. So I thought I was going to drive that, and it seemed so cool at the time. So that came to mind first, but then my rational brain, also known as my wife, said, you can't afford that because you don't have any more income coming in. We don't. So I bought a Ford for the first time ever, and it's lovely, and I do like it a lot, and it was great value. But it makes you think, you know, both are relevant. Yeah, the spontaneous kind of gut instinct, spontaneous thoughts, and then your rational brain. And the thing is, for a purchase like a car, the rational brain has a lot of say. But in most small purchases or lower cost risk purchases, actually, the instinctive brain has much more sway.
Yes. Mm. Well, Dan, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
It's got to be about distinctive brand assets. In other words, figure out whether you've got any and how strong they are. And if you don't, how are you going to build them? I'm assuming I'm talking to a brand manager or CMO here. But yes, it's grossly underestimated how valuable those things are in the medium and long term to your brand success. So focus on that.
Can you dig it?
Well, what's one thing a listener could do today to put in action one of the many ideas from your book, just to get them headed in the right direction, perhaps until the book arrives in the mail?
Oh, I was going to say the piñata, but actually, because it's a long acronym.
Well, they could start thinking through the acronym.
Actually, you know, if they've listened, you know, properly to this podcast, they can go through the letters of the piñata and start thinking, you know, where is their brand at? Yeah, I'd probably do that, because that's the step back that you need to take for brand building. Yeah.
And let me ask you a question and put some pressure on you. Is there any chance I could get the visual that's on page 41 that you illustrated to include on this episode's website page at marketingbookpodcast.com?
Of course you can.
You probably need to ask the illustrator first.
I've asked myself, and he said yes. No, actually, this is a good opportunity to plug my website, isn't it? Because I don't know if you've heard this from your other authors, Douglas, but no one gets rich from publishing business books. Let's be honest. I partly do this as a calling card, but I also do it because I genuinely want to, you know, share the stuff I've learned. So I've got a website called, it's www, obviously, smartmarketing.me.
Yes, I'm looking at it right now. And we're going to include a link to it on this episode's website page.
If you do that, then basically, I mean, I'm not sure the resolution will be high enough for your you know, exclusive website, but pretty much, in fact, almost, I think every image from the Smart Branding book and the Smart Marketing book are on that website. So if you want the full color version, you can just go there. And I've put a disclaimer on the homepage to say, look, if you want to use this, please credit me, but just go for it. Use it however you wish. Just
tell you what, I'm going to include a link, because I'm looking at it right now. The brand piñata example will do that for you.
Ah, perfect.
There we go. All right. Good. Good advice. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or looking forward to reading? At one point in our conversation, you mentioned you were working on another book. Is that true?
I am. I haven't checked with my publishers about whether I can explain the name of the book, but let's just say it's about advertising.
Oh.
It's a deep dive.
Well, you know, Martin Liu, the publisher at Lid, he seems like a nice guy. So he'll probably be okay. I'm sure he'll be okay.
Well, no, to be honest, I can say my marketing book so far has been called The Smart Marketing Book, The Smart Branding Book, and my next book is about advertising. So let's face it, it's not going to take a huge leap of intelligence to figure out the name of the new book. Anyway, yes, it's and it's
you're a walking example of brand consistency.
I know. Well, I do try.
If not you, who?
Exactly. Yeah. So yes, the Smart Advertising Book is about 40% written, let's say.
Oh, okay.
And should be out next year.
Oh, excellent. Well,
early next year.
I know a guy that interviews authors of new marketing and sales books, so I can put you in touch. Yeah, he's probably not the brightest bulb on the chandelier, but his guests are really very interesting.
Nice. Well, thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll make sure to. I'll keep a lookout for that. Anything else? Any other books you've heard of?
Things I'm reading. I've started and am enjoying Why Does the Peddler Sing?
Oh, yes. I've heard
about
that.
Have you come across
that?
Yeah, by Paul Feldwick.
Yeah, it's been mentioned a few times on the show.
Oh, it's so fun. It's really good. It's so beautifully written and by someone who really has been at the heart of advertising development for a long time. So that's good. And the other one would be The Illusion of Choice by Richard Shotton.
Uh-huh.
It's all about behavioral economics, and I really enjoyed his first book, The Choice Factory. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to reading that one as well.
Well, terrific. Well, at marketingbookpodcast.com, we're going to include links to everything linkable, including your site and all the books that have been mentioned, your LinkedIn profile, your Twitter account. Now, word to you, dear listener, please reach out to Dan and congratulate him on the book and thank him for being a guest on the Marketing Book Podcast. Send him a message or post this interview on like LinkedIn and tag him so he'll know that you heard it, because you know he's probably interviewing on various podcasts. And when his next book comes out, he's going to say, well, now which ones should I reach out to come back to? So just help me out. And guests on the show have told me that they get the biggest kick out of hearing from Marketing Book Podcast listeners, and Dan, not just because they're so ridiculously good looking. And if you are listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast on your favorite podcast app like Apple Podcasts, all these links can be found by going to this episode right now and clicking on this episode's website link. The book is The Smart Branding Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand. The author is Dan White. Dan, thank you very much for returning to the Marketing Book Podcast.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure.
And that closes the book on another episode of the Marketing Book Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it and found it helpful. If you are one of the hundreds of listeners who have left an iTunes review, please let me return your kind favor by mailing you some Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks and laptop stickers. Just send me your mailing address anywhere in the world, and I'll drop it in the mail. And remember the words of the entrepreneur, author, and motivational speaker Jim Rohn, who said, "Formal education will make you a living. Self-education will make you a fortune."Okay, whenever you're ready, let's lay down that intro.
This is Dan White, author of The Smart Marketing Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand. And you are listening to the Smart Marketing Podcast.
So you may need to pull the email up because this is The Smart Branding Book.
What did I say?
You said The Smart Marketing Book, which we'll talk about.
No, actually, you should keep this in because, I've made my fame out of The Smart Marketing Book.
Yeah, well, there's also a Smart Marketing Podcast with marketing props. This,
all right.
This is the Marketing Book Podcast.
You could argue that this was a bit of a fail. Should we try again? All right.
Okay.
This is Dan White, author of The Smart Branding Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand. And you are listening to the Smart Marketing Podcast.
Almost. It's the Marketing Book Podcast.
What did I say?
The Smart Marketing Podcast.
Oh, you know, you can. Oh my God, you can see how that works because I'm obsessed.
It should be on the email.
It's my. No, I do, Douglas. I do know the name of your podcast.
Okay.
It's just I'm a branding expert, and therefore, if I can get the word "smart" in at any point,
yes.
I will.
Well, I appreciate the implication that it's a smart show because the guests are, but sometimes the host is a little. Yeah.
All right. Oh, let's try it again.
Okay.
God, this could be a long evening. Okay, here we go. This is Dan White, author of the Smart Branding Book, How to Build a Profitable and Resilient Brand. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Excellent!
I know! Wasn't that perfect?
Yes.
First time as well.
It's time to get down to business with $30 a month business internet. WOW Business offers 99.9% network reliability so that you can keep your business moving. $30 a month gets you 30 megabytes per second with 24/7 US-based support, a price lock guarantee, and a 60-day satisfaction guarantee. Lock in our lowest priced offer for the support you need. Go to switchtowowbusiness.com. Offer for new customers with a 2-year agreement subject to change. Prices do not include taxes, fees, and equipment charges. Restrictions apply.